I want to speak about something from 2 weeks ago, Sedra, Vayigash, and Asara Bateves, which occurred since that time, and something from next week, Sedra. And there's a connection between the two of them, as you will see. Since we don't have that much time, and I want to really cover both of these, I would appreciate if you hold questions till the end. Okay. Okay. The Asara Bateves coincided with the Sedra of Vayigash, and Vayigash speaks about Yaakov Avinu going down into the first Golus, into the first exile in Mitzrayim, and Asara Bateves commemorates the beginning of the first exile when the Babylonians laid siege to Jerusalem, and that began the process of the ultimate destruction of the first temple, and then that led to destruction of the second temple and so on. Okay, thinking that there are four aspects to Gaulus, and they are the following. The first aspect of Gaulus is that we don't have control over ourselves. We don't rule over ourselves. We have a foreign power ruling over us, and that is the aspect that's called Shibud Malchios, okay, being subjugated to the nations of the world. Second aspect of Gaulus is that we we are in constant danger, vulnerable to the attacks and the plans, both physically and spiritually, of the nations of the world. The third aspect of Gaulus is that we are not united, but we are mafuza or mafurad bein ha'amim. We are scattered amongst the nations of the world. There's no unity amongst the Jewish people. Our unity is achieved in its ultimate when we are in Eretz Yisrael, everybody together, goy echad ba'aretz, one nation unified in Eretz Yisrael, and the Maharal says that that unity is only possible in Eretz Yisrael. And you may be wondering, here we are in Eretz Yisrael, what kind of unity we have, but the opposite is the case, because the greater potential for good has an equally great potential for negative. So if we can see how much disunity there is in Eretz Yisrael, more than anywhere else in the world, you can understand the potential for unity here in Eretz Yisrael too. And the last, perhaps most obvious aspect of Gaulus is that we are not in Eretz Yisrael, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, we are missing prophecy, we're missing, the Torah is diminished, our Kiddush, our holiness is diminished when we're in Gaulus. So those are the four aspects of Gaulus. Now, an interesting point, I think, is the following, that these four aspects, in my estimation, correspond to the four fast days that we have to commemorate the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The first fast day is Asara Bateves, and that is the day that we lost control over ourselves. The Babylonians laid siege to Jerusalem, and basically they controlled who came, who went, and what we could do, what we couldn't do. So the beginning of Shibud Malchios, of being subjugated to the nations of the world, corresponds to the 10th of Teves. On the 17th of Tammuz, the walls of the city of Jerusalem were breached, and the Romans entered the city. According to some, the Babylonians also in the first temple entered the city on that day. That corresponds to the other aspect of Gaulus, where we are vulnerable to the dangers and the harm from the nations of the world. Till then, we had these walls that protected us. Now the walls came tumbling down, and the Goyim are in the city. We are easy prey to their harm. Tisha B'Av obviously corresponds to the aspect of the loss of Kedusha. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed on Tisha B'Av. And the third of Tishrei, which is Tzom Gedalia, the Navi says that until Gedalia was killed, most Jews remained in Eretz Yisrael after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. They didn't leave Eretz Yisrael. But when Gedalia was killed, that's when there was a mass exodus from Eretz Yisrael, and most Jews left the country. So the killing of Gedalia precipitated the fact that we were no longer united in Eretz Yisrael, but were scattered amongst the nations of the world. So these four aspects of Gaulus correspond to the four different fast days. Another interesting point. And that is that there is a halacha that if, in fact, Asara B'Teves would fall on Shabbos, unlike all the other fast days, except for Yom Kippur, which is a Torah fast day, but all rabbinic fast days are pushed off to the next day or made earlier. Tainus Esther, if it falls on Shabbos, then we fast on Thursday. If Tisha B'Av, Shavuot B'Tammuz fall on Shabbos, we fast on Sunday. We never fast on Shabbos. But it says if Asara B'Teves could fall on Shabbos, it can't according to the calendar that we have, a set calendar. But if it could, then we would have to fast on Shabbos. Because the Navi describes Asara B'Teves as Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, the midst of the day. And that's the same exact terminology the Torah uses by Yom Kippur. And from there we learn that you fast even on Shabbos. Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh has to be in the strength of the day, no matter what the day is. So similarly, one of the Rishonim says that if Asara B'Teves would fall on Shabbos, we'd have to fast on Shabbos. And in fact, Asara B'Teves can fall on Friday, and often does. And when it falls on Friday, we fast on Friday. We don't make it earlier on Thursday or make it to Sunday. We fast on Friday and break our fast with Kiddush. So the question, though, is why? I understand the terminology in the Navi is that we'd have to fast on Shabbos, but why is that the terminology? Why is this different than all the other fast days? I was thinking, if you think of the correlation that we made, the answer is very simple. If the four fast days correspond to the four aspects of Golus, then three of them didn't actually happen on that day, Mamish. For instance, when the Romans broke through the walls of Yerushalayim, that didn't necessarily mean that they harmed us. It meant that we were vulnerable now to them more than we were before. The potential was there, but it didn't necessarily mean that the actual harm came on that day. It may have taken 2 days, 3 days, a week, whatever, until they actually started harming Jews. Okay, but they broke through the walls on that day. Potentially the harm was there. Tisha B'Av, the actual destruction of the Beis HaMikdash did not happen on Tisha B'Av for two reasons. One is that the actual destruction of the building didn't happen until the next day on the 10th of Av. It's just that towards sunset on the 9th, the Beis HaMikdash was set aflame. But it didn't actually get burned till the next day. So the potential for destruction physically was there. Beyond that, spiritually, the spiritual destruction of the Beis HaMikdash took place years before. The Shechin already left the Beis HaMikdash years before. So the actual destruction of the Mikdash, physically and spiritually, didn't happen on that day, but it reached its culmination on that day. The same thing goes with Gitzom Gedalia. All Jews didn't leave Eretz Israel on the 3rd of Tishrei as soon as Gedalia was killed. That just set in motion, right, the process where eventually Jews left Eretz Israel. But it didn't happen on that day. Therefore, if that day, whether it be Shavuot or B'Tammuz, Tisha B'Av, or Tzom Gedalia, falls on Shabbos, the day is not that significant. And therefore, you can push it off to another day. But what happened on Asara B'Teves, we lost our control over ourselves. That happened on that day. As soon as the Babylonians laid siege to Yerushalayim, at that moment, we lost control over our coming and going. We were already subjugated to the nations of the world. We no longer had our own control over ourselves. So what happened on that day wasn't just the potential. It didn't just set a process in motion. It actually happened. The negative effect happened on that day. And therefore, it has to be fasted on that day. It's Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh. That day is significant. I was thinking of another thing. And that is that to correspond or to counteract these three negatives of Golus, we have these four negatives of Golus. There are four positive things that we do, or we did at least in the first Golus, that preserved us and enabled us to get out of Golus. What were those four things? We didn't change our names. We didn't change our language. We didn't change the mode of clothing that we wore. And the fourth thing, there's different medrashim, But in one medrash, the fourth thing is they didn't speak Lashon Hara one on the other. Those four things enabled us to persevere and to eventually get out of Golis. Now, I think that those four things correspond to the four things, the four aspects of Golis. And let's see how they work. The fact that we did not change our names corresponds to the control that the Goyim, the subjugation that we are subjugated by the nations of the world. Because the Goyim pretty much call the shots, but they can't tell us who we are. We don't make our name subjugated to them. The name represents the essence of the person. And therefore our essence remains in our control. We decide who we are. We call ourselves our names. So therefore that corresponds to subjugation to the nations of the world. But in one area we're not subjugated to them. We determine who we are. Second, they didn't change the manner of clothing. That corresponds to the idea that we're scattered amongst the nations of the world. But even if we're scattered, if we stand out amongst them, and you can pick out a Jew by his yarmulke or his head covering or whatever, by a woman or whatever, or the way she dresses modestly when everybody else is in a state of undress, so you can pick out the Jew, then that unites us. Because we're not scattered and lost. You can see who Jew is. You can see the Jews standing out by their clothing. The idea that we didn't change our language, we speak Lashon HaKodesh, because the Lashon, the speech, represents the essence of the person. And the Neshama is represented by speech. And therefore, we were given a Lashon that's holy because we have a holy Neshama. In fact, we say that in our davening on Sholosh Regalim. You chose us, you distinguished us from all the nations of the world. How so? By exalting us from all the languages. You gave us a language that's holy, that represents the fact that we are holy. So our language and our holiness go together, and since we speak Lashon HaKodesh, the Ramban says, why is Lashon HaKodesh called the holy tongue? Because all holy things were given in this tongue. The Torah was given in this, the Nevi'im were spoken to in Lashon HaKodesh, and so on. Now there's another thing that it mentions. I mentioned there were other possibilities of things that preserved us in Galus. One was that we did not abrogate the mitzvah of Bris Milah, and the other one was that we're not immoral, sexually immoral. And those two fit in with this too. They also bolster the idea of Kedusha. Kedusha is being chaste, and the Kedusha is also keeping Bris Milah. So those also kept a certain amount of holiness and counteracted the loss of holiness. And the fact that we didn't speak Lashon Hara preserved us from the other aspect of Galus, that we are vulnerable to the dangers and the damage of the nations of the world. When we don't damage each other, then we merit not being damaged by the nations of the world. When we speak Lashon Hara against each other and damage each other, then we don't deserve to be protected from them. So these four things, the name preserved us to counteract the subjugation to the nations of the world. Language preserved our holiness. Clothing preserved our unity. And not speaking Lashon Hara preserved us from harm. That ultimately we could shake off and God would redeem us from Galus. Okay. Now, another interesting point. When the first Galus started, the Galus in Mitzrayim, many of these points really were not yet very severe. For instance, we were not scattered amongst the nations of the world in that first Galus, because we all were united in Egypt. The entire family of Yaakov was in one place. So that aspect of Galus really didn't apply. The aspect of Galus that we were subjugated to the nations of the world was at a minimum, because the nation of the world that we were subjugated to, which was Egypt, had as its ruler, for all practical purposes, a Jew, Yosef.
And the fact that we were endangered there was very minimal because Yosef protected us. So those three aspects of Gaulis didn't really apply so much to that original Gaulis, yet Yaakov Avinu was terrified of going down into this Gaulis. That seems to imply that the major aspect of Gaulis is not the fact that we're scattered, the fact that we're in danger, or the fact that we are subjugated, but the major aspect of Gaulis is the fact that we lose our holiness. And when we're not holy, we don't have our full holiness, then the other things are a result. When you don't have that full holiness, then you're in danger, then you're going to be scattered. The unity comes from being holy. If you're not holy, you're scattered. And then what's it called? Also, we are subjugated to the nations of the world. As it says, if you accept upon yourself the yoke of Torah, God takes off of you the yoke of Malchus, the yoke of the nations of the world. When the Torah is diminished, when holiness is diminished, so we are subjugated to the nations of the world. So all the other three aspects are really an emanation from that major aspect of Gaulis, losing our holiness. Now, if that's the case, then there's a very important lesson for us here today. Because we also are in a Gaulis that to a certain degree doesn't seem so bad, because many of the aspects of Gaulis don't seem to apply to us. We here in Eretz Yisrael are in Eretz Yisrael, and we are united. Jews are for the most part in one place, and we are not subjugated to the nations of the world, because we have our own government. We're in control. One second. Don't take away my thunder. I'm leading up to something. And we have Eretz Israel, we have Mekomos HaTorah, right? So and also we're not that much in danger because we have an army that can protect us. So one could think to a certain degree that this Gaulis, not so bad. We're in Gaulis, okay, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, right? The Shechinah hasn't returned yet, but it's minimal. Truth is, it's much worse, because none of that is true. Because this Gaulis is even worse, because when you think that you're well and you're sick, you're much worse off than when you know you're sick and you're sick. We think we're fine. We don't think we're in such a Gaulis. We're living here in Eretz Israel. We think everything's fine. The truth is, all the things I said are not true. We are not scattered, right? Look at all the machlokas that exists in the Frum community, every aspect of it. Haredi, Dati, right? Everybody's fighting with everybody else. Frum Jews with non-Frum Jews, non-Frum Jews with non-Frum Jews, right? There's two Jews, there's three parties. That's the call. It's worse scattering, but it looks like we're all together. Looks like we're all in the same place. But none of us are in the same place. Secondly, we are in control of ourselves. We have our own government, but our government is in control, being controlled by people overseas, we are being bushwhacked from without, and from Blair's and from all the European community, to a certain degree, they called the shots. And so we are meshubed to the nations of the world, but we think we are in control of ourselves. And we're not in danger because we have an army, but the army to a certain degree is not able to do anything to protect us or to protect Jews all over this country. Right, and that's pretty obvious. Right, we're in danger from all kinds of dangers, physical and spiritual, and nobody is there to really protect us.
So, and the basic Kedusha is missing. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash, even though we have a Kosel HaMaravi, that's one wall, exterior wall of the Temple Mount. We're missing all the other four walls, the interior walls, and all the interior. So that's a poor excuse for a Beis HaMikdash. And the Shechina isn't here. So the results of Golus, even in our better situation, is still a very bitter Golus. But sometimes we lull ourselves into thinking that that's not the case. And that makes it even worse. So therefore, since the major protection of the Jew against the fact that we lost our Kedusha is to remain individually and communally holy, and we do that partially by Loshinu Es Lashonam, by not changing our language. And that may seem strange in an English-speaking shiur to speak about the importance of Lashon HaKodesh, but we should realize, all of us, that the fact that we speak English, okay, is not really the ideal, right? We should be speaking Torah in Lashon HaKodesh. And even Rabbi Menashe Klein, who is a Choshev Posek, bemoans the fact that the yeshivas, even in America, opted to teach in English and not in Lashon HaKodesh. Right? It's at least that would maintain a certain amount of Kedusha. And we should realize that we do it for a reason. Because Torah can be learned best, according to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in the person's mama lashon, the language that you were raised on. Because that's the one you understand the best. You may know other languages, but you always have to translate back into that original language. Once you have to do that, something's lost. So if it's a question of understanding the shir, understanding the Torah, or speaking Lashon HaKodesh, understanding the Torah, because Lashon HaKodesh is not just the form of the language, it's the substance of the language, what you're speaking. If you have Yediot Achronot or Haaretz in Hebrew, that's not necessarily Lashon HaKodesh, okay? The substance of what's there is the antithesis of Kedusha, right? It is, in fact, the Rambam says, why is Lashon HaKodesh called Lashon HaKodesh? Because there are no proper nouns for the sexual organs in Hebrew. There's only kinuyim, there's only euphemisms. That makes it a holy language. In modern Hebrew, they've created plenty of nouns for anything you want to speak about that is the most derogatory, explicit kinds of things. So modern Hebrew and Lashon HaKodesh do not necessarily coincide. And what is written in Hebrew, if it's not Kodesh, it's not Lashon HaKodesh either. So if it's a question of sacrificing form or substance, you sacrifice the form, not the substance. And that's still Kedusha. But ideally, that's a B'dievet. Ideally, we should all learn Hebrew to the point where that should be our Mama Lashon. And we should understand it better than we understand any other language, including English, and therefore be able to learn Torah better in that language than others. But when it's not possible, it's not possible. And it's interesting that the 10th of Teves was not the only fast day. There used to be two other fast days that preceded Asarah B'Teves. The 8th and 9th of Teves were also fast days. They used to fast 3 days in a row, eating at night in between. The 8th of Teves is the day that Talmi HaMelech forced the Jews to translate the Torah into Greek. And it says it was as difficult, it was as tragic as the day that the Luchos, the tablets, were broken by Moshe Rabbeinu. That's how bad it was. Now, on the surface, what was so terrible? It was the first art scroll, Chumash, right, in Greek, which was the spoken language of the time. What was so terrible? That they had the Torah in Greek. A lot of Jews didn't understand Hebrew. Now they had the Torah in Greek. The answer is art scroll we decided to do so Jews could be able to understand the Torah better in the vernacular. Here the Goyim wanted it in Greek so they could take it. They could claim that it's their literature. It's literature. When the Goyim learned Torah, they didn't learn it with any Kedusha. They learned it as literature. They wanted to take the Torah and convert it into literature. That already is like breaking the Luchos. We don't have control anymore over it. It's not our Torah anymore. But the Goyim have control. They'll tack a New Testament onto it and call it the Old Testament. It's already in their control. And if it wouldn't be for Torah Shabbal Peh, they'd be able to control it completely. But since the most of the Torah is oral, we still control it. But when the written Torah was written in Greek by the Goyim for their purposes, that was like the day that the Luchos were broken. Now it says that, what's it called, that the ninth day of Teves was the Yahrzeit, the anniversary of the death of Ezra HaKohen. Ezra was the one who stopped assimilation after Golus Bavel, had the men and women get rid of their spouses who were not Jewish, and he was a Kohen. He was, what's it called, added Kedusha to the Jewish people. He also was a Sofer, Ezra HaSofer. The Sofer was, because he counted every letter in the Torah. There's also the idea of Hebrew. Every letter is important. Every letter has a different meaning. If you learn it in English, you just get the gist. You don't get every letter that has myriad of ideas and secrets hidden in them. So these 2 days preceded Asara B'Teves very, very much within the theme. The first day was the day that Lashon HaKodesh was to a certain degree attacked, and the next day was when Ezra HaKohen, right, Ezra Sofer died, who fought against assimilation and the destruction of holiness amongst the Jewish people. And then comes Asara B'Teves, Churban, where we are subjugated to the nations of the world. So the idea, what's it called, the Shalom, so a few things about Lashon HaKodesh, and then we'll go on to the second topic. The Shalom HaKodesh says that without Lashon, without some Kedusha, no nation could exist. There has to be at least a something, a spark of Kedusha that gives them the ability to exist. So there's no language that doesn't have some words of Lashon HaKodesh that are lost in them. When the 70 languages were formed, a little bit of Lashon HaKodesh fell into every language. That's why we find Totafos is Tat in one language, and Katfi and Pat in another language means two, because it was originally Hebrew words, Totafos, two and two, that symbolize the four batim of the tefillin. And there are many other words that you can find in other languages, including English, that obviously come from Hebrew. On Hanukkah, I always like to say, the word halal, which means hollow, obviously is connected to the word hollow, because hollow is H-O-L-L, exactly like the word halal, hollow, halal. So in any case, there are many words like that. Mobile comes from yovel. Yovel means to move, right? Lahovil, right? Lahovil means to move from place to place. Mobile means to move from place to place, to be movable, right? In any case, so that's what the Shalom HaKadosh says. And the Eitz HaChaim from the Achia, the Maral's brother, says that there are four milas of Lashon HaKodesh over every other language. One is, it's a very concise language. Sometimes you can see that what you put in Hebrew, if you try to translate to English, it's like double the size. Okay, very concise language. And what's it called? It's very a simple, easy language, not a complicated language. It's also a clean language, like the Rambam says. There are no nouns for negative, derogatory things. It's all only euphemisms. And this is Lashon HaKodesh. It's the language that God used to create the world and to give everything of holiness in. And it says that's why, what's it called, Yosef, when he wanted to identify himself to his brothers, he told them, I'm speaking Hebrew, and he showed them the Bris Milah, that he preserved his Kedusha, because if he hadn't, then he would have been, what's it called, assimilated and swallowed up by Egypt. And that's why Paro, what's it called, could not, speak Hebrew. That doesn't mean he couldn't have gone to Berlitz and learned Hebrew, but he didn't have Lashon HaKodesh. It's impossible for a person who has no Kedusha to master Hebrew as Lashon HaKodesh. He can speak Hebrew, but he'll never master the language as Lashon HaKodesh.
says the first mitzvah that Moshe Rabbeinu did with the Jewish people is to teach them Hebrew. Before he gave them any mitzvahs, first they had to learn Hebrew because they couldn't have gotten the Torah otherwise. They couldn't learn Torah, they couldn't understand what God was talking about had they not known Hebrew. So the Rambam says a mitzvah kala, an easy mitzvah is learning Hebrew. It's a mitzvah to learn Hebrew. So Moshe Rabbeinu ran the first ulpan in the desert before the Jews could do anything else with Torah. They had to know the language that the Rebbeinu was going to speak to them in. So he had to teach them Hebrew. Therefore, it's a mitzvah to learn Lashon HaKodesh. And it's the first mitzvah that precedes all of Torah. It's an important mitzvah because all of Torah depends on knowing Lashon HaKodesh. And therefore, the Torah says, the Gemara says, that when a child begins to speak, his father speaks to him in Lashon HaKodesh and teaches him Torah. Because the two have to go together. Can't teach him Torah if he doesn't know Lashon HaKodesh. And the Yerushalmi says that a person who speaks Lashon HaKodesh and eats fruit in purity and reads Kriya Shema morning and evening is assured that he'll be a Ben Olam Haba, speaking Hebrew. And the Korban Ha'ed over there says the idea here is eating fruit in purity leads to purity of the body, speaking Lashon HaKodesh leads to purity of the soul. So therefore, by maintaining our Kedusha, one aspect of that is speaking Lashon HaKodesh, which has two ideas, form and substance, the language, Hebrew, and also the substance to speak things that are holy, whatever language you speak them in. That's called Lashon HaKodesh. Okay. What? Yeah, but not everyone. There were a lot of Jews there who were idol worshippers, a core of Jews preserved. But there was also, you know, Shinui, and there was also a lot of other people there. So not all of them were speaking Hebrew all the time, or Lashon HaKodesh. Okay, now, Me'inyan Le'inyan. Next topic. I think we're going to be able to finish this. Next topic's from next week's Sedra, and it has a connection to the first topic. The book of Shmos is called the book of Shmos because Ve'ela Shmos B'nei Israel, the names. So it starts with names. It's also called Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption, of creation. And Bereshis means in the beginning. Fits very nicely. Vayikra, God called to Moshe from the Mishkan, taught him Torah's Kohanim. That's the theme, the laws of the Kohanim. Bamidbar, whatever happened in the desert happened between the first census and the last census when they exited the Midbar. So this is a book about what happened in the desert. It's called Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of the numberings, the counting in the beginning, counting in the end. And Devarim are the words of Moshe who reviewed the Torah, Mishnah Torah. So they go together, the theme and the name. Here the theme is redemption and the name is Shmos. What does names have to do with redemption? Not only that, it says that one of the merits we had to get out of Golus was Loshinu Eshmam. They remained with Jewish names, didn't change their names. And there is a concept of name that it says also that God... as feels the Jewish people are very precious. And how does he show his preciousness, how much he considers us precious? He gives us everyone a name and counts us and mentions us by name over and over, just like every star has a name. I think I once told you, I just heard it again this time. Somehow I'm always in Chutz Lars in the end of December. And they're announcing on the radio an advertisement. In case you have somebody who has everything, so you don't know what present to give them during this season, so if you send, it started with $25 about 10, 15 years ago, now it's up to $75. If you send $75 to a certain address, they will name a star for the person that you want to give the present. They will send him a certificate certifying that the star has been named in his name, and they will register it in the star registry, which will be registered as a book in the Library of Congress. All of this is a scam, because I can register anything as a book in the Library of Congress. It has absolutely no validity to anything.
right? So it's not registered in some kind of scientific guild that's responsible for naming stars. You'll never see it in any star guide, but if you go to the Library of Congress, there'll be a book that has your name in it that says this star is named for you, which means nothing. You could do that too for not less than $75. Much less. So, and you could write a certificate that this star is named for me. So go out tonight, take a piece of paper, right, go out, call all the stars you want for your whole family, and it's for free. But people are spending $75 to have this darn, and it's no more valid than doing what I just told you to do. So that's the idea. God calls every star by a name. I don't think he pays $75 per star, but in any case, he gets to call all the stars by, what's the big deal? So what? So, and it also says that when Yaakov Avinu looked at the names of his children, he saw the two letters don't appear in any of their names. The letter Ches and the letter Tes, Chet. No sin in their names. So he said, wow, I'm going to tell him when Mashiach's going to come. And then he saw the two other letters don't appear. Kuf and Tzadik, Kates, the deadline, the final time. I can't tell him when Mashiach's going to come. The Kates is not there. So in order to understand what all that means, we've explained in the past that the name of anything, and I'll bring you some sources in a second, represents its essence, its talents, abilities, capabilities, is contained in the name in Hebrew of that thing or that person or whatever. And therefore, when it says that God gives a name to every star, it means that every star has its unique characteristics, its abilities, capabilities, talents, what it's supposed to accomplish. No two stars are the same. They all have a different spectrum. They contain different different gases and different materials and in different proportions.
And, stars die all the time.
Right. And they're what?
Stars die all the time.
Right. Okay. Whatever. But stars are, there's a need for every different kind of star. And when they all have their time and their place or whatever. And therefore, the Jewish people are the same. That, what's it called? That every Jew has his unique place in this world, right? His talents, abilities, his time and place also. And therefore, Yaakov Avinu saw that his children have no sin in their names. Potentially, they're perfect. They could reach perfection. If they can, they don't have to wait till the deadline. Mashiach can come at a deadline, the final time, Kates, or it can come earlier if we deserve it. So he saw that if his children would just realize their potential, they could bring Mashiach earlier. Therefore, there's no deadline in their names. The cage doesn't exist. Because according to their names, Mashiach could come much earlier. Doesn't have to wait till the deadline. In any case, the Sefer HaBohir says, everything that God created, its name represents its essence. And that's why it says, whatever man called that thing, that was its name, meaning that was its essence. The name represents the essence. In Emunah and Bitachon from the Ramban, he says everything about every aspect about a thing is hinted to in its name. And the Tanya, right, the Baal Tanya writes that all creatures, every creation in the world, right, the names that we call it in Lashon HaKodesh, they are in fact the letters that God spoke when he created that thing and brought it into being. In other words, the essence of that thing are the words that God said to bring it into a being. God willed things, spoke them into being. And the speech, the letters that he spoke, are the thing themselves. Those things materialized because of those letters. Those letters are what we see as the name of the thing. So the letters of the name represent the root of the essence of that thing and everything that it is. That is the thing. The name is the thing. And the Shaloh HaKadosh says that the name of anything represents its root. And the same thing we find by human beings. Shma Garim. Therefore, the name has a causative factor. The name a person has, to a certain degree, aligns itself with what that person is, can be, will be, or whatever. And the Tanchuma says that it can be good or bad. And therefore, a person should be careful when he names his child to name him a good name. Right? Not to short-circuit him with a name that's a negative name. To call him, you know, what's it called? In Israel today, Nimrod is a popular name. Right? Nimrod was not exactly one of the more, foremost tzaddikim of the world. Huh? Lilit, okay, whatever. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh says the name is representative of the neshama. In fact, Shem is the inner letters of neshama. Neshama is Nun and Hey on the outside, and Shin Mem, Shem, in the inside. The Noam Elimelech says that an interesting idea, he says. He says, since the name connects to a person's neshama directly, the name and the neshama are very closely connected. He said, that's why there's an interesting phenomenon. Somebody's deeply asleep. You can wake him up faster by calling his name than by shaking him. Because what happens when a person's asleep? His neshama is like out there somewhere. Okay? So when you shake him, you're only dealing with his body. But when you call his name, you're getting to his neshama and you're bringing it back. So he wakes up faster. So he says, the Magid Mimezrich, the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov, says that because of that, the names that people are given are not arbitrary. God gives understanding subconsciously to the father and mother, right, to call the child the name that he wants to be called, and to give him a name that fits that person. And the Arizal says the same thing, and therefore, there's an interesting halacha. If, when you want to name your child, the father, let's say, is naming the child, and the mother and father agreed on a name. They're going to call the kid Shmuel. And the father was all nervous, got mixed up, and he said Shlomo instead of Shmuel. Okay? And the person named the child Shlomo. The halacha is that that name sticks, because it's obviously Min HaShemayim. However, if the father said Shmuel, and the guy who's naming the child got mixed up, and he said Shlomo, that doesn't stick at all, because he has no right to name somebody else's kid. Right? And I only made you my shliach if you do what I want. Right? So then it doesn't stick. But if the father made the mistake, and he actually named the child that name, it should stick. Unless there are problems like he named him his name. Right? He get, by mistake, he said his own name. So we don't name for ourselves. Right? So then it could be you're allowed to add another name or change a name or whatever. It says also when the person is named, the Bnei Yisachar says, that brings the Kedusha onto the Neshama, or even the Neshama comes from the higher worlds down here when the person is named. The Amudei Shamayim says that the name of a person, if you would really know how to get into it, it's not just the name as we see it. It's every letter, every part of the letter, the numerical values of the letter, the hidden roots of the letters, everything is included in this. So it's not just the name as we call the name. It's everything included in the name. He says that the name includes in it everything that person will do, every characteristic he has, good or bad. It's all parav. He could use those qualities for the good, he could use them for the bad. But the name represents the qualities and potential the person has. Those are parav. Whether he uses them for the good or not, they're the same potential, the same characteristics. And he says, even by a Rasha, who may have good qualities, so those good qualities also he can use minimally or use them for the bad. And the Be'er Maim Chaim says also, that's why today we don't change people's names, even when they're sick. We add a name, but we don't change names. Because in order to change a name, you're dealing with a person's essence. You may short-circuit his whole neshama to give him a name that doesn't fit. Right, you're giving him a 120 name or 110 name, and he has a 220 name. So maybe not fit. So we don't know how to make the transformers today. So therefore, we don't change names. We just add a name. He says also the Sefer Hasidim says that sometimes you have a name of a person with a name, that if you name for that person, everybody who has that name is matzliach. And sometimes you have a name of a person, and everybody's name for that person is the opposite. It's not matzliach. The Magid Meisharim says, to the point where somebody who's called Avram will have an etiya, a certain predisposition towards chesed, like Avram. Yitzchak, Avoda, Yaakov, Emes, and so on. Okay? And even a Rasha will have a predisposition to that. He could, again, not use it, suppress it, use it for the bad, use it for the good. But it's there. There's a certain predisposition. Okay. And the Reb Chaim Falaji says an interesting thing. He says it's not just the name, your name for somebody. You have the same name, and therefore there's a connection between your neshamas. But if your name for somebody, somebody important or somebody, an ancestor or whatever, you should learn about that person, and try to emulate the good points. So it's not just an automatic thing, it's also a learning process. Who you're named for, learn about that person. The Bnei Yisachar says something interesting in this week's Sedra, based on this idea of names. He says that when Paro called in the midwives and was going to command them to what's it called, to kill the babies, the boy babies. So it first says, Asher Shem Ho'acha Shifra V'Shem Ashenis Pua. Okay? First it tells us their names, then it says what Paro wanted to do. That seems extraneous. So he says, Paro first changed the names. Their names were not Shifra and Pua. Their names were Yocheved and Miriam. Paro changed their names. Shifra and Pua are Egyptian names. Okay? That's what Bnei Yisachar says. He says that Paro knew that with Jewish names, these Jewish women would never kill little babies. But he felt if he could just change their essence a little bit by changing their names to Egyptian names, then he has a chance that they would listen to him. Now, it's interesting. I was thinking that therefore the Rabban Shalom made it that those Egyptian names also had Hebrew connotations, as Rashi says. Shifra Shemeshaperes Esavlad, that she made the child nicer. And Pua, that she would, coo to the child, which are names that showed the opposite, to preserve the child. So the Rabban Shalom made, when Paro wanted him to have Egyptian names, in order to destroy them, he made the Egyptian names have a connection to Hebrew, where it had the opposite connotation of preserving the child. And that's why Chazal say that everybody has four names. That Hashem gives you, the name your parents give you, the name your friends give you, the name you give yourself. Meaning, everybody has different characteristics. Some come directly from God. Your neshama was created with its own unique characteristics. Then there's the name you get from heredity. Some of the characteristics you get, you inherit from your parents. Some of the characteristics you have, you learn from your environment. That's the name your friends give you. But the main one is what you do for yourself. All of that is only potential. It can be used for the good, for the bad. It can be suppressed and ignored. If you bring it out for the good, then that's the name you make for yourself. And that's what it says, Re'e Parasi B'Shem Bezalel. When Bezalel built the Mishkan, God pointed out, I called the name of Bezalel, which points out to us that Bezalel was a very talented person. He was a carpenter, a jeweler, an architect, a builder, a big Talmud Chacham, a Kabbalist, everything. Where did he get those talents? God gave it to him. He was a slave in Egypt. So they were God-given talents. Why did he have those talents? So he could be able to build a Mishkan. So we learn from there that every Jew has a name, has a unique talents, abilities, capabilities. And they're given predominantly to be used somehow in service of God. In the service of the Jewish people, in the service of Torah, and so on. Okay. That is the first half of this part. Now the second, and I guess not a half, we'll see. And that is the halachic aspect of naming a child. Okay? First of all, when do you name a child? So by a male, we name him by the bris, because that's when his Jewish neshama comes into him, by the bris. So you coincide the name, like we said, as a connection to that. What if the child is either not going to have a bris, right, because he's sick or whatever, or is he had two brothers that died because of a bris, not going to have a bris? So then there's a difference of opinion. Some say that you should name him Dafka before the eighth day. So before the eighth day, he's not an Oril, because he's not fit to have a bris yet, so he's not considered uncircumcised, he's just in limbo. Some say you should name him Dafka after the eighth day, and some say if there's a Pidyon HaBen, you should name him by the Pidyon HaBen, if he's a Bechor. And if, in fact, there's going to be a bris, it's just pushed off, then you wait till the bris, unless the child is really sick and you want to daven for him, then you can name him before the bris, so you can have a name to say to daven for. And then, like we said, there's a difference of opinion whether you do it before the eighth day or dafka after the eighth day. A girl, some say, there's a few different minhagim, some say you name her the day she's born. Not necessarily by Kriyas HaTorah, just give her a name the day she's born. Some say you wait till the first Torah reading, wherever that may be, Monday, Thursday, Shabbos, first Torah reading after the birth, you name her then. Next opinion says you wait till the first Shabbos, no matter what. Even if the child's born on Sunday, you wait till Shabbos and name her on Shabbos. Some say the second Shabbos, Okay, you name her, in order that the mother should be well, because it takes a week for the mother to get better. So by the second Shabbos, she's also better, and therefore name her when the mother can be happy too. Some say you wait till 30 days and name her on the 30th day. One reason is that by 30 days a person is considered already definitely going to live. Up till 30 days is Sufik. And also women are compared to the moon. They have cycles like the moon. So 30 days is a cycle of the moon cycle, therefore the girl is named at 30 days. Okay, who calls the name? Who has the right to call a child a name? Obviously the parents. Okay? It says that if you argue about the name, especially in the home where the child is, it's a danger to the child. I always tell that to grandparents who start fighting over, well, I want a name for my this, or the other side says the other one, and there's, right, what's it called? And sometimes they say, I don't care, I'd better see the kid dead if he's not named for my mother. So that doesn't help. But in any case, that's what the Oath of Omen says. Now, Ashkenazim have a custom that the first child, boy or girl, the mother names the child. She has the right. They can do it together or whatever. She can, you know, give up on her right. Unless the father's parents are not alive, one of them or whatever, and they want a name for the father's parents, then the father's parents come before the mother's parents because of Kibbutz. So if the first child has to be named for one of the parents of the father, then the mother relinquishes her right. But if not, if everybody's alive and you're not naming for father's parents, the mother has the right to name for whoever she wants. And then the next child, the father has the right, next child, the mother, and so on. The Sfardim have a minig, not all Sfardim, but some Sfardim have the minig, that the mother names all the girls and the father names all the boys. Okay. The minig today is to call children according to by ancestors, parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, and so on. Okay. And by Sfardim, even for living ancestors. Okay, by Ashkenazim, only for deceased ancestors. The Samsofer holds that that was such a strong minhag to name only for ancestors that he, even though he has a Rebbe, Reb Nosson Adler, who was his Rebbe Muvak, he didn't name any of his children Nosson. Only what's called, even after Reb Nosson Adler died. He only named for relatives. The Torah Tumimah explains, why is that the minhag? Why do we name for relatives? Because since we're in Gaulis, and people lose their roots in Gaulis, you're moving around constantly, to maintain some kind of stability, we name for ancestors that maintains a stability in Gaulis. Another reason is it does a nachas ruach for the neshama, to have somebody in this world named for them. And also, it has a hashpah, it has an influence on the person who's being named, when you name them after somebody who was a good person. And you're also mekayim the mitzvah of kibud horim by naming for an ancestor, grandparent, or whatever. Some say you can also name for teachers and for other tzaddikim also, a possible thing. Now, who don't we name for? You don't name for wicked people because shem reshoim, yirka, the name of the wicked should, decay. You don't name the thing. In fact, the Medrash said, do you ever see anybody who couldn't name this child Mat Nimrod or Paro? Today, that's not a question anymore. Right, Omri, yeah, okay. How they ask the question, though, how come there are Tanoim named Yishmoel? Rebbe Yishmoel, right? Yishmoel was not exactly one of the great tzaddikim, so they say a few answers. One is Yishmoel did tshuva. He died at tzaddik. Secondly, it's only when the name represents the rishus, like Nimrod. Nimrod was called Nimrod because he made the world rebel against God. So with the name represents his evilness, then you don't name that kind of name. But if the name has nothing to do with his evilness, like Yishmoel, Shmaikel, has nothing to do with his evilness, you can call Yishmoel. Others say that any name mentioned in the Torah, you could name, right? According to that, Nimrod would also be okay. Others say that since Yishmoel was named by God, right, named by God, that also is makes him a different. Okay. Also, if there was somebody else who had that name, also some say that if the person wasn't a Rasha to begin with, he became a Rasha later in life, so you're naming for when he was a Tzaddik. Okay? Or if there's another Tzaddik. I remember my first... What? No. From the time that he was Bar Mitzvah and on. My first... do you mind going another 5 minutes? Anybody? What? I mind that. And we're almost finished, but it's some interesting things here. When I had my second daughter, we had four daughters first in a line. So my grandmother, who lost her husband before I had my first daughter, and wanted that first child to be a boy so she could name her for her husband, then was a girl. So by the second girl, Ray, she got a little nervous. So my grandfather's name was Shlomo. So we added a name to my daughter, Tzipora Shalamis, for Shlomo. Then the next one came, the next one with two girls. Then we had boys. So we named the next one Shlomo. Okay, in any case. But in any case, so originally we were going to call her Shlomis, not Shulamis. Shlomis was even closer to Shlomo. But then I reminded myself, Shlomis Bas Divri was not a very positive character in the Chumash, right? She was the only woman who was violated by an Egyptian in Mitzrayim. And she was a talkative person. So she wasn't really a positive role model. So I wanted to ask my Rosh Yeshiva about naming her, because he had a daughter whose name was Shlomis. I found it very indelicate to ask him if it was okay to name my daughter Shlomis, since he named his. So I went and I said, we're thinking of calling my daughter Shlomis. What does Rosh Yeshiva say? So he said, you know, my daughter's name is Shlomis. I said, no, I really didn't know that. So he said, because there was another Shlomis. Shlomis was one of the queens of the Chashmonaim, who was a tzaddikus. So you name for that Shlomis, not for this Shlomis. But it always bothered me, how did that Shlomis get her name? How did her parents name her Shlomis? I have an answer to that. Because it used to be they didn't name for other people. They named for something that happened, Baruch HaKodesh. They used to name people because of whatever, right? Not because they're naming them for somebody else. So this Shlomis was not named for somebody else. She was named because something happened at her birth, and the parents named her for that occurrence. So then it was fine. But today, when you're naming for somebody, then you have to, what's it called, worry about who else had that name. Okay. If you want a name for a relative who was not necessarily a tzaddik, person wasn't frum or whatever, but there's an idea still of kibud av va'em, so then you name and have in mind somebody else. If the person's name was Moshe, have in mind Moshe Rabbeinu also. And also you can add another name too. We can add a name, Moshe Yaakov, Moshe Yosef, or something, so it's not exactly the same name, that's also okay. Giving Goyish names, not Hebrew names. So if you're doing it in order to assimilate, it's 100% also from the Torah. If you're not doing it to assimilate, then even though it's not preferable, it's better people should have Hebrew names, but it's, Moshe Feinstein says that in Mitzrayim, where we had nothing to differentiate to us between the Goyim, because we didn't have a Torah yet, then the name was very important to differentiate. Today we have a Torah that differentiates us. The name is not all that important. And if you're not naming Dafka to assimilate, but you're naming that the child should have it easier socially or whatever, right, then a non-Jewish name is also okay. Also, we don't name for people who are Raya Mazli, who had bad mazel, meaning they died young or they died a tragic death. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that it's Dafka, somebody who died younger than 50. If they already lived to 50, that's not something that's considered negative. And they died without children.
What about Shmuel?
Shmuel HaNavi lived to 52. That's why he says 52. So he said that's why he says 50, because of Shmuel. He says it could be people, you know, the Arizal died at 30-something, right? The Arizal. So many Gedolim died young, but that was the amount of time they had in this world. So if they had children and they died young, that's not something negative. You can name for that person. If they died less than 50 without children, then it could be a problem. What you do is you add another name. People who are killed al Kiddush Hashem, people who died in the Holocaust. There, for two reasons, there's no problem naming for them without adding a name. One is that it wasn't their mazel. That was something that was a worldwide thing. So you can't say it was their bad mazel that they were killed, whatever. And also, it wasn't bad mazel. Like, you died al-Kiddush Hashem, which itself is a positive thing in the end analysis. How about, there's also a custom not to name people from people before Avraham Avinu. Most people don't have that custom because there's a lot of Noachs running around. And also, we find that Tanoim had names of people before Avraham. Binyamin ben Yefes. Yethis is the name of Noach's child before Avram. And what's it called? Akavya ben Mahalalel. But again, that's no proof either. Because then they didn't name for people. They named for occurrences. So these people weren't named for somebody else. They were named for an occurrence. Today, when we name for people, then it may be a problem of naming for somebody before Avram Avinu. Another thing, another custom. We don't call two children the same name. It could be very confusing. Or even to call them, you know, Moshe 1, Moshe 2, you know, number 1 son, number 2 son. We don't name them that either. Even with another name. We don't name one kid Moshe Chaim and the other one Moshe Yosef. Right? You don't have different names for different children. Surely you don't call a boy and girl by the same name, meaning Yona and Yona. Yona could be a girl's name, it could be a boy's name. If you have two kids, one boy, one girl, you don't call both of them Yona, or both of them Simcha, or some other name that it could be for boys or girls. However, if there's a little bit of a change, you could call one of your kids Aryeh and the other one Leib, because Leib in Yiddish is lion. But even though it's the same idea, it's different names. Or Rosa and Shoshana. You could have a Rosa and a Shoshana in the same family. Some people don't name boys for women, but they do name girls for men. Okay, and some might name boys for girls, girls for boys. Doesn't make a difference. That's a more prevalent minig that you can name. Like we said, we named our daughter for a Shlomo, and you could name a son for a, and make the name a masculine sounding name, Masha into Moshe or something like that. Okay, there's also, some people have the custom not to name more than one name, or to never add a name, what's it called, to call for two different people, and to combine, because they say that it's not neither person. If you want a name for a Moshe and a Chaim, so you call the person Moshe Chaim. You can't do that, because Moshe Chaim is not Moshe and it's not Chaim. Others hold no. Moshe Chaim is two names. Moshe has two names, Moshe and Chaim. Okay? The Amshar Shlomo said that there was a guy who wanted to name his kid, and there was a fight whether it should be for his father-in-law or his father. His father's name was Meir, and his father-in-law's name was Uri. So as a compromise, they named the kid Schneer. Two Ors, Meir and Uri, together. Okay. So we see from there that even naming a slightly different name is considered like naming for the person. And we also see from there that maybe they didn't want to name two names. But it could be over there was another problem. There was also a fight. Who comes first? Is it Meir Uri or Uri Meir? So they solved the problem by calling him Schneer, which probably didn't make anybody happy, so everybody was upset after that. Okay. And it says that it's proper to make a simcha on the day that you name a child. By the boy, it's usually by the bris, so you make a simcha anyway. And by the girl, it's proper to make a little kiddush or something, to make a simcha the day that you name a child. And some people even don't say tachnun, the day that they name a girl. Okay. Okay, usually the customs follow the father's customs, usually. However, if the grandfather is not makbid, who's alive, or the father who's alive is not makbid, he says, I don't mind if you call for me, right? Then he can be mavater, and you can call for even for a living person. Right, even if he's not a svar.